Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Darwinism, Marxism, and Freudianism as we see the author Yaki examining 19th century thought, to which he opposes 20th century thought, as he's been talking about in earlier recordings we've done. And he's going to show how it's outmoded, but the two are still in competition as the one struggles to break free of the spirit of an earlier age. So we're picking up on page 66 out of 600 plus. Darwinism, and again, he doesn't number the chapters, but they're divided into sort of six major sections, and we're most of the way through the first section just to locate ourselves. Darwinism, 66 page. One of the most fruitful discoveries of the 20th century was the metaphysics of nations. The unveiling of the riddle of history showed that nations are merely different manifestations of the soul of the high cultures. Remember that he's saying that each culture, the biggest overview is that there are 8 or 9 genuine cultures that Spengler studied, and he's accepting that, and that these cultures are organisms. That means they're unique expressions, and they have lifespans, and they have or go through parallel stages of sort of primitive, classic, and then mannerist, as they would say in art, correspond to concern with the internal, the soul, and then it transfers to the external political and economic world, as we've heard, I think it was last session. And he's also saying that within these cultures there are different spirits of different age. There are ages, and there are spirits of those ages, and there are different nations, which are equivalent to organs of the body. Then there are individuals, I guess would be cells. And this is the idea of organic and unique historical expression as opposed to linear. He says, the unveiling of the riddle of history showed that nations are different manifestations of the soul of the high cultures. So the soul of the high culture exhibits itself through the various nations of France, and Germany, or the lands that made up Germany, or England, or Italy. They exist only in cultures, nations. They have their lifespan for political purposes and progress vis-a-vis the other nations of the culture, individuality. I left out possess. The nations exist only in cultures. They have their lifespan for political purposes and possess, vis-a-vis the other nations of the culture, individuality. So France is distinct from a Germany and distinct from an England. Each great nation is given an idea, with a capital I, a life mission, and the history of the nation is the actualizing of this idea. And frankly, Harold, from where I sit, it looks damn peculiar. Just felt I had to interject that there. The history of the nation is the actualizing of this idea. This idea, again, must be felt and cannot be directly defined. Each idea, to actualize which a given nation was chosen by the culture, is also a stage of the development of the culture. Thus, Western history presents during the recent centuries a Spanish period, a French period, an English period. They correspond to Baroque, Rococo, and early civilization. These nations, and remember, they see civilization as a more of a degenerate or a post-cultural sense, when the civilization is the period when we've moved on to economics and politics versus culture, which is art, religion, philosophy, and the inward man is more important. Again, all that last session. These nations owed their spiritual and political supremacy during these years solely to the fact that they were the custodians of the spirit of the age. And again, in German, that's Zeitgeist. Zeit meaning times, Geist meaning spirit. With the passing of the age, these custodians of its spirit lost their spiritually dominating position in the culture. The early civilization was the English period of the West. Again, the English being a mercantile race, a nation of shopkeepers, as was famously said, but they're also an island nation defined by their relation of water. They use that water to build a giant navy and spread around the world more than any other nation. And when any time that you have ports, you're going to have more of a inherently more of a mixture of people and patois developing and around the docks, and more of an interchange of products, which is an interchange of ideas and ferment and turmoil. Sort of similar to a war, but more of a commercial sense. They become a great commercial trading nation, and this is their contribution, and this is the onset of civilization in the West, and their ideas spread more to other lands. You got the rise of the bourgeois, the middle classes, the traders, the people who aren't nobles but are gaining some money and want some power. The early civilization was the English period of the West, and all the thought and activity of the whole civilization was on the English model. All nations embarked upon economic imperialism of the English type. All thinkers became anglicized intellectually. English thought systems ruled the West, systems which reflected the English soul, English life conditions, and English material conditions. Prime among these systems was Darwinism, which became popular and thus politically effective. Darwin himself was a follower of Malthus, or Malthus, and his system implies Malthusianism as a foundation. That is, a constant doubling of the population until a collapse point occurs when it goes beyond its food supply. Malthus taught that the population increase tends to outrun the increase of food supply, that this represented an economic danger, and that checks on this population increase alone can prevent it from destroying a nation, such as epidemics and wars, unhealthy living conditions, and poverty. Malthusianism expressly regards care for the poor, the aged, and orphans as a mistake, but Malthus has been proven wrong because the food has continually outstripped the ability of the population to increase. It's like the people who are always betting on peak oil. It's similar to that mentality. They're basically veiled or secular religious chiliasts or millennialists who believe that there's an end times a coming. And if they cover it with pseudoscience, as with global warming or with peak oil or other garbage like that, they are inevitably proven wrong. You know what the gas is here in the Ville and the Nemo? Nemo being northeastern Missouri. Gas is 145. You know, not even half the price of like milk. And I don't know if you know this, but milk comes from cows. Cows get up and create fresh milk every single day, whereas oil, we don't really know. We don't know if oil regenerates. Some people think it does. I think most of them think it doesn't. The point is, we're not exactly running out of all these things the way a lot of people like to think. There is stuff that's not economically efficient to get at this time, but if it becomes more rarer, then it becomes in people's financial incentive to go after it. That's the beauty of the market. Anyway, Malthusianism expressly regards care for the poor, the aged, and orphans as a mistake. A word on this curious philosophy. First, it has no correspondence whatever to facts, and therefore is not valid for the 20th century. Statistically, it has no basis. Spiritually, it shows complete incomprehension of the prime fact of destiny, man, history, all capitalized, namely that the soul is primary, and that matter is governed by soul conditions. Every man is the poet of his own history, and every nation of its history. A rising population shows the presence of a life task. A declining population points to insignificance. This philosophy would legitimate a man's existence by whether or not he is born into an adequate food area, which might be true of unthinking animals, but it's not going to be true of humans, because humans remake the environment to suit themselves. His gifts, his life task, his destiny, his soul are put at naught. It is one example of the great philosophic tendency of materialism, the animalization of culture man. So he's saying that the materialists, essentially, whether they in so many words deny it, say that man doesn't have a soul, doesn't have a culture, doesn't have an inward necessity that unfolds as his destiny, regardless of his fate, which is determined partly by external incidents he has no control over or knowledge of. But they insist that man is no more than a talking animal subject to the same laws of reproduction and increase in natural destructive cycles when the food runs short. So he's underestimating man is what he's saying, and misdefining him. And I think he's right about that. Now, again, it is one example. His gifts, his life task, his destiny, his soul are put at naught. It is one example of the great philosophic tendency of materialism, the animalization of culture man, culture capitalized, culture hyphen man, culture man. Malthusianism taught that the food population ratio imposed a continuous struggle for existence among men. This, quote, struggle for existence became a leading idea for Darwinism. The other leading ideas of Darwinism are found in Schopenhauer, Erasmus Darwin, Henry Bates, and Herbert Spencer. Schopenhauer in 1835 set forth a nature picture containing the struggle for self-preservation, human intellect as a weapon in the struggle, and sexual love as an unconscious selection according to the interest of the species. Schopenhauer. In the 18th century, Erasmus Darwin had postulated adaptation, heredity, and struggle and self-protection as principles of evolution. Bates formulated before Darwin the theory of mimicry, Spencer the theory of descent, and the powerful tautological catchword survival of the fittest to describe the results of the quote-unquote struggle. How do you know it's the fittest? Well, it survived. They're defining a thing in terms of itself is what tautology means. It means essentially a circular argument. Tautology. It's a good word. And you can gobsmack people, as the English say, by telling them that survival of the fittest is circular argument. How do you know it's fitter? There's no independent criterion. Say, if Joe grows to the height of 9 feet, Joe is a giant. You see, we have an independent criterion. You say, well, Joe grew the height of 8 feet, 2 inches, so he's not a giant. According to Panther standards, you know, or whatever, in human standards, a giant would be assessed. The independent criterion, we declare people who are in the top, I don't know, whatever it is. I literally don't know, but like, or even if they think of it this way, but 0.001% of the population to be giants. So everyone who's over 6'8" and is male is considered a giant. For females, it's 6'2", is what I always heard. But the point is there's an independent criterion for judging what you're saying. Even if you made it up yourself, it's still there. Whereas survival of the fittest, it sounds really good, but how do you know that something is fitter? What's your criterion for measure? Oh, it survived. Okay. You're defining it in terms of the thing you're measuring. You need some other way of determining if you the way a theory has power if it can predict things. So if you say, okay, well, how do you know one thing is fitter than another? You take two random individuals and one survives, it's because it's fitter. Maybe simply an accident happened to the other one. I mean, there's lots of ways you can think about it where you can see that it's circular. Now, Yaki says, this is only the foreground for actually the road from Darwin back to Calvin is quite clear. Calvinism is a religion, and remember, Calvinism is the idea of the elect. We talked about in the feminization of American culture, and there are various ways of proving that you were among God's tiny, select, elect. Typically, with Calvinism, it's by proving you have better material conditions, i.e. more money than everyone else. That's a sign of God's favor. And an indication, if not a proof, that you are among the elect. So this can really drive people to become super materialistic and the Yankee sharper and traitor and Vera penny pinching in order to prove that you are one of the chosen ones, just like in the Old Testament, just their model, you see. So isn't it funny how the religion and the science intertwined? So he says, for actually the road from Darwin back to Calvin is quite clear. Calvinism is a religious interpretation of the survival of the fittest idea And it calls the fifth the elected. Just as today these same people who want to prove they're morally superior would call themselves politically correct. Well, yeah, I care about these things. Others don't. I'm superior morally, breathes out of their every pore. Darwinism makes this election process mechanical, profane, instead of theological, religious, selection by nature, instead of election by God. Isn't that, that's a very, see, and he's not just come up with a solid idea, he's expressed it mnemonically, that is, in a way which best aids the memorization or the memory of it. Selection by nature instead of election by God, or selection by nature in Calvin, in Darwin, replaces election by God in Calvin. And you'll remember that Darwin himself had a very strong religious background, and even wrote that he was very disturbed by what he was coming up with. His mind was forcing him to draw certain conclusions that in his heart he felt were at war with what he knew of Christianity, which was quite a lot. So almost against his will, he was forced onto the road that led to his theories. By observing, see, he overcame his religious background in order to observe reality and at least make an honest attempt to interpret it. Honest, why? Because it can be falsified. Unlike religious claims, which is why they're so popular, because they can't be falsified. You can just make up anything and put it in the mouth of God. That's why religion is popular, and it's also why it's antisocial, whereas science is pro-social, because science comes to you with an objective, independent criterion for measuring its validity. But religion simply asserts. Religion ultimately has no argument other than cutting your head off. Whereas science can prove what it's saying with evidence, even if charlatans do attempt to put out false evidence. Darwinism makes this election process mechanical, profane, instead of theological, religious, selection by nature instead of election by God. It remains purely English in the process, for the national religion of England was an adaptation of Calvinism. That was a very fruitful paragraph, I feel. The basic idea of Darwinism, evolution, is as little novel as the particular theories of the system. Evolution is the great central idea of the philosophy of the 19th century. Evolution is the idea of the 19th century. It dominates every leading thinker in every system. Schopenhauer, Proudhon, Marx, Wagner, Nietzsche, Mill, Ibsen, Shaw. Playwrights, philosophers, writers. These thinkers differ in their explanation of the purpose and technique of evolution. None of them question the central idea itself. With some of them it is organic, with most purely mechanical. Darwin's system has two aspects, of which only one is treated here, for only one was effective. This was Darwinism as a popular philosophy. As a scientific arrangement, it had considerable qualifications, and no one paid attention to these when converting it to a journalistic world outlook. As the latter, it had a sweeping vogue and was effective as part of the world picture of the age. The system shows its provenance as a product of the age of criticism, capital A and C, in its teleological assumptions, that is, assumptions about the purpose toward which everything is directed, the end times toward which all is directed, the ends of the system. Evolution has a purpose, the purpose of producing man, civilized man, English man, in the last analysis, Darwinians. It is anthropomorphic, the, quote, aim of evolution, unquote. Evolution is a natural force that has aims, is not to produce bacilli, but humanity. It is free trade capitalism, in that this struggle is economic, every man for himself, and competition decides which life forms are best. It is gradual and parliamentary. For continual progress and adaptation exclude revolutions and catastrophes. It is utilitarian, in that every change in a species is one that has a material use. The human soul itself, known as the brain in the 19th century, is only a tool by which a certain type of monkey advanced himself to a man ahead of his fellow monkeys. Teleology again. Man became man in order that he might be a man. Man became man in order that he might be man. It is orderly. Natural selection proceeds according to the rules of artificial breeding in practice on English farms. And so these are all the characteristics of this form of thinking. Anthropomorphic, utilitarian, teleological orderliness. And so that ends section one of his Darwin and Roman numeral two. As a worldview, Darwinism cannot, of course, be refuted, since faith is, and has always has been, and always will be, stronger than facts. Nor is it important to refute it as a picture of the world, since as such it no longer influences any but day-before-yesterday thinkers. However, as a picture of the facts, it is grotesque from its first assumptions to its last conclusions. Darwinism is grotesque as a picture of the facts. In the first place, there is no struggle for existence in nature. This old Malthusian idea merely projected capitalism onto the animal world. Such struggles for existence as do occur are the exception. The rule in nature is abundance. There are plenty of plants for the herbivores to eat. There are plenty of herbivores for the carnivores to eat. That's a little more dubious, because they definitely run in cycles, like foxes eating rabbits or hawks and rabbits run in cycles. Between the latter, there can hardly be said to be a struggle, since only the carnivore is spiritually equipped for war. A lion making a meal of a zebra portrays no struggle between two species unless one is determined so to regard it. Even so, he must concede that it is not physically, mechanically necessary for carnivores to kill other animals. They could as well eat plants, and here he verges into the ridiculous. It is the demand of their animal souls, however, to live in this fashion, and thus, even if one were to... He's verging on Mary Baker Eddy level of craziness, or the people who try to feed their cats vegetarian diets. It is the demand of their animal souls, however, to live in this fashion, and thus, even if one were to call their lives struggles, it would not be imposed by nature, but by the soul. It thus becomes not a struggle for existence, but a spiritual necessity of being oneself. The tiger is a tiger because he wants to be a tiger. That seems to me a dubious assumption. The capitalistic mentality, engaged in a competition to get rich, quite naturally pictured the animal world also as engaged in an intensive economic contest. Both Malthusianism and Darwinism are thus capitalistic outlooks, in that they place economics in the center of life and regard it as the meaning of life. Well, you know, I see all these suburban kids and they all wear North Face, and a lot of them wear UGG boots. They're very much of a theme. But we know that the founder of the North Face died in Patagonia. How ironic is that? No, I think that's just a bad joke and not a true fact. He died down in some lake down in... Basically, the guy had bought a gigantic area that he was saving. So he used his capitalistic riches to do great philanthropy, and he died upside down from hypothermia in a lake out, taking his 70-year-old plus body out there to kayak around in a lake somewhere in Tierra del Fuego. One of those areas, Patagonia, Tierra del Fuego. I don't know. You know, it's all the same to me. But one of those areas down in South America. So the point is, if all life's a struggle, then these capitalists really believe that they're awfully philanthropic. That's where the philanthropy comes from, far more than it comes from the religious type of man who wastes his life, you know, caring for lepers. Like, what's their ultimate one? Mother Teresa. I mean, that's disgusting. Which one is doing more good for the world? Nah, it's not that capitalists can't do bad. They certainly can. You look at Bill Gates is doing Mother Teresa work on a continental scale, trying to improve the lives of Africans at the expense of effective people and promoting H-1B and that type of thing. Anyway, natural selection was the name given to the process by which the unfit, quote-unquote, died out to give place to the fit, also quote. Adaptation was the name given to the process by which a species gradually changed in order to be more fit for the struggle. Heredity was the means by which these adaptations were saved for the species. As a factual picture, this is easier to refute than it is to prove. And factual biological thinkers, both mechanists and vitalists, like Louis Agassiz, Dubois Raymond, Reinke, and Driesch, rejected it from its appearance. The easiest refutation is the paleontological. Fossil deposits found in various parts of the Earth must represent the possibilities generally. Yet they disclose only stable species forms and disclose no traditional types, which show a species evolving into something else. So he's making directly the religious argument against evolution, which is funny. And yet there's more to that than people think. It was Tom Bethel in the American Spectator, maybe I mentioned this before, who first read in my ears that I had not realized when I first heard it, that Darwin's survival of the fittest is circular. Tom Bethel writing in the American Spectator decades ago. And he would make very good arguments against evolution. I think evolution is likelier than creation, but it's certainly not proven the way that scientists like to claim that it is. And they get very defensive, just in the way religious people do when you question them about it. They turn very red in the face. They don't want to hear it questioned. That's a sign of weakness. Defensiveness is always a sign of weakness. It's there's something you're trying to protect. You're ashamed to let me look in your belly and see what lies in there. You know, your heart. What are you eating? What are you eating with your head? What's in your head? What's in your gray cell? What's in you? Just the way we study a giant snake. You know, they've had the python round up down in Florida, and they caught like 82. They're getting better at it. They're getting better, man. And they like to study the contents of these snakes' stomach in order to know a little more about them. What they're up to, what they're about, what they're all about, man. What they're eating. Maybe they're eating guinea fowl. Maybe they're eating pine cones. I don't know, man. It's not up to me to judge. The pythons abide like the dude in the Big Lebowski. Did you know that sweaters like he wore in that go for about $250 online? I just happened to come across that the other day. That's just a fun fact from me to you. Now, let's keep going here. I wish I had some cowboy boots made out of a emerald python or emerald tree boa. I always call the one by the other. Well, there's an emerald tree boa and a green tree python, but I always say emerald tree python. But they don't actually exist. But they all have that beautiful chartreuse color, and it'd be awesome to have a pair of cowboy boots made out of a chartreuse python. And let's see. Okay. Where were we? Now, here we are. Okay. So he says there's no fossils showing something evolving into something else. There's no intermediate stage fossils, is what the religious types would say. And then, in a new fossil hoard, a new species appears in its definitive form, which remains stable. The species that we know today and for past centuries are all stable, and no case has ever been observed of a species adapting itself. Oops, a disaster cause headed by outside, as I'm told my great-grandmother, whom I never met, used to say. I think she was from back east. The species that we know today and for past centuries are all stable, and no case has ever been observed of a species adapting itself to change its anatomy or physiology. Excuse me, Jesus Christ. Which adaptation then resulted in more fitness for the struggle for existence and was passed on by heredity with the result of a new species. Darwinians cannot get over these facts by bringing in great spaces of time, for paleontology has never discovered any intermediate types, but only distinct species. Nor are the fossil animals which have died out any simpler than the present-day forms, although the course of evolution was supposed to be from simple to complex life forms. And what Tom Bethel and others would say is that when you look In a science textbook, as fed to the public through the government schools, what you typically see is evolution of animals presented as the evolution of, say, car models. So that if we look at Buicks from, say, 1957 to 1997, we see a clear yearly annual technical improvement. And that parallel goes very naturally over to animals. And it makes sense, it's plausible. And so people accept it and believe it, but it's not true, or it's not necessarily true, or it's not proved true. It's presented as true. Very important is, so far as I can tell, that is accurate. The religious types are right in their criticism of evolution, which does not mean they are right in what they positively assert. Again, nor are the fossil animals which have died out any simpler than present-day forms, although the course of evolution was supposed to be from simple to complex life forms. This was crude anthropomorphism. Man is complex. Other animals are simple. They must be tending toward him since he is higher biologically. Calling culture man a higher animal still treats him as an animal. Culture man is a different world spiritually from all animals and is not to be understood by referring him to any artificial materialistic scheme. If this picture of the facts were correct, species ought to be fluid at the present time. They should be turning into one another. This is, of course, not so. There should actually be no species, but only a surging mass of individuals engaged in a race to reach man. But the struggle, again, is quite inconclusive. The lower forms, simpler, less fit, have not died out, have not yielded to the principle of Darwinian evolution. They remain in the same form they have had for, as the Darwinians would say, millions of years. Why do they not evolve into something higher? The Darwinian analogy between artificial selection and natural selection is also in opposition to the facts. The products of artificial selection, such as barnyard fowls, racing dogs, racehorses, ornamental cats, and song canaries, would certainly be at a disadvantage against natural varieties. Thus, artificial selection has only been able to produce less fit life forms. Nor is Darwinian selection in accordance with the facts. The female does not, by any means, always choose the finest and strongest individual for a mate in the human species or in any other. The utilitarian aspect of the picture is also quite subjective, i.e., English capitalistic parliamentarian, for the utility of an organ is relative to the use sought to be made of it. A species without hands has no need of hands. A hand that slowly evolved would be a positive disadvantage over the millions of years necessary to perfect the hand. Furthermore, how did the process start? For an organ to be utile, it must be ready. While it is being prepared, it is inutile. But if it is inutile, it is not Darwinian, for Darwinianism says evolution is utilitarian. Good argument. Saying that the argument of evolution is self-refuting. If looked at closely, it falls apart, and I have to agree. I agree. The way that it's normally presented is the development of the eye, and how would that conceivably happen? It would require so many changes at once, it would be impossible. Now, I have personally not read into the intelligent design. I've just read some articles talking about the more significant books that have come out, which I can't even name, but years ago it was a bigger thing. Michael Behe, I think, was one of them, if that's how you pronounce it, Behe. But I'm willing to listen to anything on that because I know that the religious are right in their criticism of Darwinism, which is they're saying what he's saying here. But that doesn't mean that their claims are correct. That's where I differ from them. I don't think they prove their case for creation. Now, then again, I also don't worry about it that much because it's not something that's really amenable to easy proof or proof that I'm certainly going to discover. It will be someone other than me who eventually discovers the real truth. And when that happens, I will accept it, assuming I'm alive, which I doubt. I'll probably not be alive at that point. I think it'll be long in the future. Now, let's see. Actually, all the techniques of Darwinian evolution are simply tautological. Thus, within the species, it is individuals which have a predisposition to adapt themselves that do so. Adaptation presupposes adaptation. The process of selection affects those specimens with definite aptitudes which make them worthy of selection. In other words, they have already been selected. Selection presupposes selection. The problem of descent in the Darwinian picture is treated as finding the interrelations of the species. Having assumed their interrelationship, it then finds they are interrelated and proves the interrelationship thus. Descent presupposes descent. Selection presupposes selection. Adaptation presupposes adaptation. It's all circular, he's saying. The utility of an organ is a way of saying it works for this species. Utility thus presupposes the existence of the very species which has the organ, but lacking that organ. The facts, however, have never shown a species to pick up a certain missing organ, which seemed necessary. A life form needs a certain organ because it needs it. The organ is util because it is util. The naive, tautological doctrine of utility never asked, utility for what? That which serves duration might not serve strength. Utility is not a simple thing, but entirely relative to what already exists. Thus it is the inner demands of a life form which determine what it would like to have, what would be useful to it. The soul of the lion and his power go together. The hands of a man and his brain go together. No one can say that the strength of the lion causes him to live the way he does, nor that the hand of the man is responsible for his technical achievements. It is the soul in each case which is primary. Well, I don't know. My soul demands that I have 6 fingers on my left hand, only my left hand, but I have not yet been able to evolve that 6th finger. This is very disturbing to me. And nearly all of my lapses and absences can be explained by it. Yes, this attempt to evolve a 6th finger. Honestly, he's verging on Mary Baker Eddy territory here, in my opinion. Now, let's see. This primacy of the spiritual inverts the Darwinian materialism on the doctrine of utility. A lack can be util. The supply makes the demand. The necessity is the mother of the invention, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. He's saying that in different words. The primacy of the spiritual inverts the Darwinian materialism on the doctrine of utility, usefulness. A lack can be util. The lack of one sense develops others. Physical weakness develops intelligence. In man and in animals alike, the absence of one organ stimulates others to compensatory activity. This is often observed in endocrinology in particular. End of that subsection. The whole grotesquerie of Darwinism, nice to see him use a word the way Mencken would. No one else would use the nominal form of grotesque, except Mencken and Hirayaki. Everyone would use just simply grotesque as the adjective, but few would say grotesquerie, use the noun of it the way Mencken would. He specialized in that, among other things. The whole grotesquerie of Darwinism and of the materialism of the entire 19th century generally is a product of one fundamental idea, an idea which happens also to be non-factual to this century, even though it was a prime fact a century ago. This one idea was that life is formed by the outer. This generated the sociology of environment as determining the human soul. Later it generated the doctrine of heredity as doing the same. And yet, in a purely factual sense, what is life? Life is the actualizing of the possible. Kind of reminds me of Tip O'Neill's politics is local. Politics is the art of the possible. I forget who said that. Life is the actualizing of the possible. The possible turns into the actual in the midst of outer facts, which affect only the precise way in which the possible becomes actual, but cannot touch the inner force, which is expressing itself through, and if necessary, in opposition to the outer facts. He was his own elimination. Remember I quoted that from Pale Fire and Vladimir Nabokov? the author of Lolita, but Pale Fire is a work that's very hard to explain. But that I always remember that phrase. I used that last time. That's kind of what he's saying. You're saying that we're all these internal things that burn, and the external is the elimination, and outer things can can affect us or even kill us. But our life is our destiny, is the unfolding of our inner necessity. And that is it is that makes the world around us, even as it's partly conditioned by or affected by it, but it's not determined by it. It's determined internally, is what he's saying. Neither heredity nor environment determine these inner possibilities. They affect only the framework within which something entirely new, an individual, a unique soul, will express itself. The word evolution describes to the 20th century the process of the ripening and fulfilling of an organism or of a species. This process is not at all the operation of mechanical utility causes on plastic, formless, protoplasmic material with purely accidental results. His work with plants led de Vries to develop his mutation theory of the origin of species, and the facts of paleontology reinforce it to the extent of showing the sudden appearance of new species. The 20th century finds it quite unnecessary to formulate mythologies, either in cosmogony or biology, cosmogony, how universes are formed. Origins are forever hidden from us, and a historical viewpoint is interested in the development of the process, not in the mysterious beginning of the process. This beginning, as set forth by scientific mythology and by religious mythology, has only an historical interest to our age. What we note is that once these world pictures were actual and living, what is the actual history of life as this age sees it? Various species of life exist, ranked according to increasing spiritual content, from plants and animals through man to culture man and high cultures. Some of the varieties, as shown by fossils, existed in former Earth ages in their present form, while other species appeared and disappeared. A species appears suddenly, both in fossil finds and in the experimental laboratory. Mutation is a legitimate description of the process, if the idea is free from any mechanical utility causes, for these latter are only imagined, whereas mutations are a fact. Each species has also a destiny and a given life energy, so to speak. Some are stable and firm, others have been weak, tending to split off into many different varieties and lose their unity. They have also a lifespan, for many have disappeared. Not just many, all but less than 1%, in fact, as I love to quote. This whole process is not at all independent of geological ages nor of astral phenomena, stars. Some species, however, outlast one Earth age into the next, just as some 19th century thinkers have survived into the 20th century. Darwinians also offered also an explanation of the metaphysics of their evolution. Roux, for instance, holds that the fit for the purpose survive while the unfit for the purpose die. The process is purely mechanical, however, and is thus fitness for purpose without purpose. Nageli taught that an organism perfects itself because it contains within it the principle of perfection, just as Molière's doctor explained that the sleeping potion worked because of a dormative virtue inherent in it that is totally circular. In the case of Molière, he's intending to be funny. In the case of the scientist Nageli, he's not intending to be funny, but still is funny. An A with an umlaut to make it pronounced A rather than ah. Nageli. And that may be an odd, strange, kind of like N-A-G-E-L-I. Weissmann denied the heredity of acquired characteristics. Remember, that was Lamarck, that an individual, and that's refuted. Individual acquires characteristics and passes them on to his offspring. It doesn't happen. That's Lamarckianism. And it's known to be false. And Weissmann denied the heredity of acquired characteristics, but instead of using it to destroy Darwinism, as it obviously does, if every individual has to start anew, how can the species evolve? He props up the Darwinian picture with it by saying that the germplasm, essentially saying Lamarck is right at some level. He props up the Darwinian picture with it by saying that the germplasm contains latent tendencies toward useful qualities. But this is no longer Darwinism, for the species does not evolve if it is only doing what it tends to do. These tautological explanations only convinced people because they believed already. The age was evolutionary and materialistic. Darwinism combined these two qualities into a biologico-religious doctrine which satisfied the capitalistic imperative of that age. A biologico-religious hyphenated doctrine. He loves that kind of thing. Which satisfied the capitalistic imperative of that age. Any experiments, any new facts, only proved Darwinism. They would not have been allowed to do otherwise. The 20th century does not see life as an accident, a playground for external causes. It sees the fact that life forms begin suddenly and that the subsequent development or evolution is only the actualizing of that which is already possible. Life is the unfolding of a soul. An individuality. Life is the unfolding of a soul, an individuality. Whatever explanation one gives of how life started only reveals the structure of his own soul. A materialistic explanation reveals a materialist. Similarly, the imputing of any purpose to life as a whole transcends knowledge and enters the realm of faith. Life as a whole, each great life form, each species, each variety, each individual has, however, a destiny, italics capitalized, an inner direction, a wordless imperative. This destiny is the primary fact of history. History is the record of fulfilled or thwarted destinies. History is the record of destinies. History is the record of fulfilled destinies. History is the record of fulfilled or thwarted destinies. Any attempt to make man into an animal and the animals into automata, that is a different word, a 19th century word for robots, automatons, came out upon the steps and sat smoking cigarettes, a slim silhouetted automaton, Wilde had in one of his poems. And thus, the product of a certain type of soul, any attempt to turn man into an animal, came out and sat upon the steps and smoked a cigarette like a live thing. And the inner reality of the soul of the high culture as being the determinant of the history of that culture. The soul exploits outer circumstances. They do not form it. The soul exploits circumstances. Yeah, like I like to say, and I think others may have said it too, the environment doesn't make me. I make the environment. The soul exploits the outer circumstances and arranges them for its own needs, according to the unfolding of its individual soul and its innate internal destiny, right? That's what he's saying. The soul exploits outer circumstances. They do not form it. Nor does the 20th century, not being capitalistic, see any struggle for existence going on in the world, either of men or animals. It sees a struggle for power, a struggle that has no connection with cheap economic reasons. It is a struggle for domination of the world that the 20th and 21st centuries see. It is not because there is a shortage of food for the human populations of the world. There is plenty of food. The question is power, and in the decision of that question, food, human lives, material, and everything else that the participants can dispose of will come into play as weapons and not as stakes. Nor will it ever be decided in the sense that a lawsuit can be decided. Readers living in 2050 will smile when told that there was once a rather widespread belief in the Western civilization that the First World War was the last war. Well, hell, they could laugh about that 20 years later. The Second World War was also so regarded, all during the preparations for the third. It was a case of wish thinking, pacifist idealism being stronger than facts. Darwinism was the animalization of culture man by means of biology. The human soul was interpreted as a mere superior technique of fighting with other animals. We come now to Marxism, the animalization of man through economics. The human soul is a mere reflex of food, clothing, and shelter. That's Marx saying economics is the structure on which all the superstructure, everything else, the economics is the real foundation of reality. of human society and everything else is superstructure built upon the economic relations of classes, which vary through the ages. And he claimed that was science. He'll explode that next. And I was going to do all three together, but I'm afraid I must disappoint that expectation and falsify my own words in a way most unbecoming, like the smile of the Grinch. But we've done enough. This is very dense stuff. And if I were a Pomonoid, I would say it's very rich. It's very rich. It really is challenging our minds to think about, wonder about. Is it true? I know that's what people like to believe. That's what a lot of people say. I'd like to think it too, but I was over there struggling with it, trying to evolve, battling it out with brontosauruses. All right. Before I do more shtick, I think we should wrap it up here. So now we're up to 77. That was Darwin. Very, very thoughtful stuff. The exact opposite of what you're going to read anywhere else. Perhaps not wholly correct, but certainly more correct than incorrect. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again to do the Marxism and the Freudianism real soon.